Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and a warm welcome to everyone here. As Gary was saying, myeloma patients are definitely living longer, and a decade ago, the median survival was 3 to 4 years, while now it is in the range of 8 to 10 years. So with all the new drugs and treatments that have been approved, it is possible to control the disease for a longer period of time. We are talking to Dr. Shaji Kumar from Mayo Clinic to explore the treatment potential of intervening early in the disease and also touch upon how personalized therapies can help in managing myeloma efficiently. We have a myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson, on the panel, along with Jack Aylo and Cynthia Shmilevsky. So I extend a warm welcome to everyone again. And I would like to tell the audience that we will be taking questions towards the end of the discussion, and you can dial in using 718-664-6574 to let us know you have a question and ask them live, or you can just post your questions on curetalks.com or email them to priya@trialx.com. Gary, over to you.
Well, thank you, Priya. Like I mentioned before, it seems like it's very timely to have Dr. Kumar on, especially with these two very important subjects, which is treating whether to treat the myeloma early once it's found in the precursor states, and then also the whole concept of individualized medicine and what that means. For one thing, I'd like to say Dr. Shaji Kumar is one of what I believe is a dream team that Mayo Clinic has put together, and it's amazing what they've done. He's a board certified in internal medicine, and his medical interests are obviously multiple myeloma and also amyloidosis as well. He completed his medical studies and his internship at All India Institute of Medicine, Medical Sciences in New Delhi. And he's also completed two residencies in internal medicine. He's been involved with the MMRF and as well as the IMF and just about every other organization, and you'll see that he is by far one of the premier medical professionals in the area of myeloma. So thank you so much, Doctor, for being here today with us. And another
thank
thing
you,
that I think is so important, and it happened not too long ago, actually it was last year, is that Dr. Kumar, along with Dr. Nupur Raji and Dr. Jagannath, had been in India and had put together a template or a consensus analysis of how to treat myeloma in India. And with a billion people or so in India, obviously there's a need to come up with a standardized approach for India. So I think that was a wonderful thing that you did, and congratulations.
Thank you.
At each of the myeloma meetings, there's a debate as to whether to treat early or not to treat early, and it's been, I think in 2016 I was there, and it was Dr. Palumbo was debating with the French doctor, and it seems like it comes up, and it just most recently came up with one that's going on currently in Europe. But I'm wondering, with the successes of the Spanish group that showed that Revlimid-Dex versus watch and wait was twice the life expectancy, and also Mayo and Dana-Farber's successes doing the same type of thing with other drugs. Hasn't this been resolved? And if so, why have we not seen some form of FDA approval for early treatment?
First of all, Gary, thank you so much for your kind introduction, and it's wonderful to be here this evening. I think you bring up a very important point, and I think this is probably the most debated topic in myeloma right now. And to just kind of give a little bit of historical perspective, you know, we know that all patients with myeloma start off with a monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance or MGUS. In some patients, we can actually, you know, discern a phase that we refer to as smoldering multiple myeloma. Now, for the longest time, and for the right reasons, the typical approach for treating myeloma had been to treat only if it's starting to do some harm to the patient, you know, any of those what we typically refer to as the CRAP symptoms. And the rationale behind that was that the treatments we had were not curative, and the treatments all came with significant side effects. And some of the medications like melphalan could even increase the risk of cancers in the long run. And then, on in the same token, there's only about 20% of the patients with MGUS and maybe about 50 to 60% of the patients with smoldering myeloma would have disease progression in the long run. So there's always the concern we are going to be treating some patients who might actually have lived their normal life without ever needing treatment for myeloma. So for all the right reasons, it was a conservative approach for the longest time. Now, what has changed in the past few years are several things. One, we understand the disease much better. We understand better how the transition happens from the MGUS to smoldering to myeloma. We have better tools to try and predict which patients are at the highest risk of progressing to myeloma. So the first step in terms of changing our approach was the change in the diagnostic criteria that happened now 3 years ago, where we said, yes, these patients have, if you have, you know, certain features, then your likelihood of moving from smoldering to active myeloma is over 80% in a short time span of 2 years. So we all felt, you know, that is probably a threshold that we all feel comfortable with, that we don't want to wait for the other shoe to drop, so to speak. So we felt that the possibility of harming patients is very low if we use that criteria for starting treatment. So we move that line a little bit so that now we start treating patients before actual symptoms start, but more because we can accurately predict who is going to get the symptoms. Now that only, you know, takes care of or only covers maybe somewhere between 5 and 10% of patients with smoldering myeloma. So the other 85 to 90% of the patients with smoldering myeloma, we at this point, we still don't want to treat because, again, the question is, are we going to harm these patients? So then the Spanish group did the trial that Gary just referred to, which is called the CURIDEX trial, where they took patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma. And this is using criteria that have been shown in the past to identify maybe a 50% risk of progression over the next 5 years. So what they did was to treat half of the patients with Revlimid dexamethasone and the other half of the patients were just watched as we do used to do before. And they showed that the patients who got the Revlimid and the dexamethasone had a better survival compared to the people who were just watched. Now, you might ask, you know, if you have the data, why aren't we doing that in our day-to-day practice? And I think that is exactly the question that Gary was referring to. Now, the problem with that study, there are two problems. The biggest problem is almost a quarter of those patients probably had active myeloma by the current definition, so they should really have been treated and not necessarily watched. Obviously, we didn't know at that time, but from the subsequent study they did, they realized that anywhere from 25 to 30% of patients whom we call smoldering myeloma actually have active myeloma if only we did a imaging study or a scan to look at the bones, something more sensitive than the skeletal survey. So that's one problem with that study. The second problem with the study is it's a very relatively small study for us to be changing our entire practice that could affect thousands and thousands of patients. So we do need at least one more confirmation of that findings in a separate study. And that study has already been completed, That is the ECOG trial that compared Revlimid versus no treatment. And hopefully we will hear something back from that in the next year or so. However, even though we won't apply the results of the CURETX trial to practice, it still gives us very important information. One of the biggest concerns we always had is we actually might make the myeloma more resistant to the normal treatment by treating them early. And the CURETX trial showed that people who actually eventually ended up getting treatment for myeloma, the initial treatment did not seem to have had any impact, and they still continue to do better. So at least the CURETX trial kind of starts peeling the first layer off by saying, yes, you're not harming anybody. Now we need another trial to peel the next layer off to prove that we are actually benefiting people or confirming that finding. And, you know, if I were to do a, you know, make a bet, I would bet that it's probably, you know, that is probably going to be the approach of the future. We just need to identify where do we draw the line so that we actually benefit more people than we harm folks.
Okay. Are you still there, Doctor?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought we might have dropped you, but so you say that you mentioned that there's a couple of questions that need to be answered, and one of which is who to treat, and you pretty much talked about that. Now, there's also another one is how to treat. You know, is it Revlimid, Dex? There's other trials in process that look at a curative approach.
Absolutely, no. I think that's a very, very important point. So I think, you know, as we're starting to explore whether we should be treating patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma, there's also a similar debate going on as to what is the right approach for these patients, right? So you could think about it two different ways, and we don't know which would be the right approach, but one approach could be that you take the patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma, give them a very light treatment over a long period of time to try and prevent the smoldering myeloma from becoming active myeloma. So that approach is kind of the more conservative way of looking at it, that we actually minimize any kind of side effect. The opposite, not the opposite, but a different perspective on the same thing is, if this cancer is indeed in the early stages and more amenable to treatments, why don't we give the best treatment that we have for myeloma, but for a limited period of time, and potentially get rid of most, or if not all, these cancerous cells that we essentially are looking at curing the disease or nipping it in the bud, which is what we do for a lot of other cancers, like early-stage breast cancer or early-stage prostate cancer sometimes. So, I think those are the two different perspectives that are being looked at in the clinical trials. So there is the Revlimid-type trials we talked about. There's the Daratumumab-type trials that are ongoing. Then there's also the more curative-type approach. So there's the Spanish trial that we already know some of the results of, which looked at using, again, combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and stem cell transplant to see if we can cure the disease. And we are doing a trial called the ASCEND trial, which is basically not going to use transplant, but trying to see if we can achieve the same thing by replacing the transplant with a monoclonal antibody like daratumumab. So instead of using transplant, we will use the carfilzomib Lendex, but add daratumumab to that. So the ongoing trials, I think, will give us a good sense as to, you know, which might be a better approach, but we still need the large phase 3 trials.
Okay, well, thank you. In the end, however, if we can, if you can't find it, you can't treat it. And late diagnosis is one of the biggest problems with myeloma. And I know they're trying to look at that based on an IMF, iSTOP, multiple myeloma in Iceland. And you know, how do we find it? You know, how do we get it to where it's not in the stage three, that it's not that you're not near death by the time you find out exactly what it is.
Right. No, I think, you know, the whole concept of screening for a disease to catch it early on, obviously, is something, you know, we always strive for in all cancers. And myeloma is probably kind of the best example because we know it takes anywhere from 10, 15, 20 years for it to go from the muggers phase to the myeloma phase. So the Iceland project is really trying to see if we can just screen the entire population and see, one, how frequently does it happen, what stage do we find them in, and what are the risk factors for developing this and for the disease to progress and so forth. So the biggest issue with screening as a concept is that when you screen and find something, you should be able to do something about it. So the crucial thing with myeloma right now is if we find it, what do we do with it, right? So we know that 80% of the people in whom we find that monoclonal protein, nothing will ever come of it, but then they could have significant issues in terms of, you know, just carrying the burden of knowing that you have something that could become the cancer, and also all the other things that go with it in terms of healthcare coverage and so forth. So that's something we need to think about, too, when you think about screening everyone. The second is if we have a really, really good tool to put people into, okay, you have the protein, but your risk of getting myeloma is less than 2% in your lifetime, and somebody else can say, yes, you have a 90% chance of getting myeloma in the next 3 years, then we know we're going to do things differently for those people. So I think the first step towards making screening a kind of a universal thing is to, one, identify at what age do you want to do it. Second, if you find something, what we have a much clearer approach as to what we do with the result. And all these trials, especially the ones in smoldering myeloma, if they consistently show a survival improvement, an overall survival improvement, that we are making people live longer, then it greatly strengthens the need or the justification for screening programs.
Well said. Now, another thing that we were to discuss today is personalized medicine. And we hear a lot about it, but in the case of myeloma, we really haven't, historically, all the patients have been given, over the course of their disease, all the drugs that are currently available and also anything in clinical trial that might be helpful. So when and how will this change, or is it changing now?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So, you know, I mean, the goal eventually is we want to try and match the drug to the patient, or even if, you know, we know that all the drugs in myeloma doesn't work for every patient, and we don't have a very good way to identify ahead of time if a particular drug is going to be beneficial for a patient. Now, up until now, we had just had a handful of drugs, especially if you think about the classes of drugs, right? We have the proteasome inhibitors, we have the immunomodulatory drugs, we have the monoclonal antibodies, and then we have the traditional chemotherapy drugs and the HDAC inhibitors and so forth. So when you have a limited number of drugs available and you have a disease that keeps, you know, has a relapsing and remitting course, we eventually end up using everything in different order. So two things can change. One is, even in the current scenario, if we can identify which treatment is going to be the most beneficial, we could potentially give that in the beginning and get the maximum benefit out of it before we go down the lane to the next treatment. But I think to make it truly personalized medicine in the future, we need two pieces. One is more drugs, which with a very, very clear mechanism of action, and two, a test that identifies the patient that's going to respond to that drug. I think we are going to starting to see that. A best example is probably the venetoclax. Now, this is a drug that is approved for treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and it acts by binding to a protein that allows the cells to survive or the cancer cells to survive. And we know that patients with the translocation 11-14, about half of them will respond to this particular drug, and there are some biomarkers that are being developed. So this is probably going to be the first example where we would do the test, find out that the patient has that particular profile that is likely to lead to a response, and then we treat the patient with that drug. Now, there are other approaches that are looking at the mutations that happen in myeloma. We know that there are about 10 or 12 mutations that are often found in myeloma cells. Even in a given patient, it may not be present in all myeloma cells, but at least some of them. Now, there are clinical trials that are looking at trying to see if we can get a drug that specifically attacks the cancer cell that carries that mutation. Now, given the fact that myeloma cells can have multiple different mutations, and also that these things can evolve over time, the future might be that we will find the top two clones or the top three clones and then try and use a combination of two or three drugs that targets those clones. So I think that would be the next step. But right now there's a trial called MyDrug that is being started by the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium that is going to look at patients with high-risk myeloma and try to use these targeted drugs in combination with the standard treatments to try and see if we can make a dent.
Very good. Well, thank you. There's so many things seems to be happening so quickly, all the new drugs that have been developed, all the great things that appear to be coming down the line, like, CAR-T and MILs and many other things like that, which are very specific to the disease. So, yeah, we're all obviously quite hopeful. What I'd like to do now is to open it up to the to the folks online, not the folks online, to the other members of the program, which is Jack. Are you online?
Yep, I'm here and I'm ready to ask questions.
There you go.
Good.
It's up to you,
Dr. Kumar. It's always nice talking with you, and I really appreciate your being on this call.
Hi, Jack.
You know, when you look at these trials for smoldering patients, typically they are for high-risk smoldering patients. And after reclassifying ultra-high-risk smoldering patients as multiple myeloma, can you clarify what the definition is of high-risk smoldering myeloma, and has that definition been standardized yet?
Yes. So there were two questions. One is, do we know who are the high-risk amongst the remaining patients? And remember that the new definition probably only moved somewhere between 5 and 7% of patients from that smoldering myeloma group into the active myeloma group. So we still have the 90 to 95% of the patients still called smoldering myeloma. Now, the same risk factors that we used to use for smoldering, high-risk smoldering before, like the quantity of the M-spike, the free light chain ratio, the monoclonal plasma cells on the flow cytometry, and so forth. Those things still hold true. We recently took a look at the Mayo data, and this is actually going to be coming out in the near future, where we found that the same factors still held true, but the numbers have changed a little bit. So instead of a ratio of 8, now it looks like maybe a ratio of 20 might be more appropriate. This is kind of a first stab at trying to see if we can modify the high-risk criteria, taking into account those truly high-risk patients who have moved out of the group. But I think the definitive answer is going to come out of this International Myeloma Working Group Smoldering Myeloma study that we are doing. So we have already collected data from about 2,000 smoldering patients across the world, and we are still continuing. Our goal is to see if we can get anywhere up to maybe 3,500 or 4,000 patients with smoldering whose data that we can collect. And then we can look in that data set and say, this is the definitive way of identifying the high-risk smoldering myeloma patients. So we are hoping that we can say, this is maybe from this effort, there might be another 5 or 10% of patients we might end up reclassifying as myeloma. But we are hoping that we could say, this group of patients have a 80% risk in the next 5 years. These patients have 50% risk in the next 5 years, and these patients have a 20% risk in the next 5 years. So the intensity of the treatment in the clinical trials could also be different depending upon, if you use this kind of a system to design your trials.
Thank you. My next question, and I think you've already touched on it, but I remember years ago that Vincent Rajkumar put out a paper about control versus cure. Myeloma. And I guess that same debate is going on for smoldering myeloma, and you talked about aggressive versus non-aggressive therapies and such. Can you tell me where do you kind of fall into that time or that line for treating smoldering myeloma?
So, you know, I firmly believe that the future, it will bear out that treating smoldering myeloma, or at least a group of patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma early, is the way to go. But I think I would hesitate to do that right now outside of a clinical trial because of all the reasons that I outlined before. You know, I think at the end of the day, we don't have tools which are – we have tools that are reasonably sensitive, but we don't have tools that are very specific. It's hard for me to tell a patient that you have a 95% risk of getting myeloma in the next year for the vast majority, because we just don't have that specificity right now.
Yeah.
So I think it's a question of getting the right tools. So I think what you just referred, you know, getting that standardized approach for defining high risk is going to be a huge, big next step before we start feeling comfortable treating a group of these patients.
And then with immunotherapy being today's hot button, if you will, would you ever consider treating a younger smoldering patient with an allo stem cell transplant so that this patient receives a new immune system and likely handle GVHD better?
Not at this point. I mean, I worry that, you know, when you think about patients with myeloma who go through an allogeneic stem cell transplant, now, 5-year survival is like 35%. Now, I think first I need to have that verification that the current standard treatments actually do make a dent in the risk of progression for these patients or in the disease before I would move to something that is so much, you know, much more aggressive and likely to have its own side effects. So the short answer is no, I would not consider an allogeneic transplant for a high-risk smoldering today. But that is a very, very valuable question that I think we should ask at some point once we feel comfortable with the concept of treating.
And then my last question follows up on Gary's question about personalized medicine, and you mentioned that we really do need more drugs that are effective against certain mutations. But the way myeloma seems, if you have a given mutation, it doesn't appear to me that a single drug will help. It'll still be drug combinations, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. I mean, knowing how much these clones escape, I don't think we will ever be able to get away with just one drug for myeloma. But what we are hoping is that if you know that this is the major clone of the disease, maybe adding this will help us get rid of the top two clones, for example, by combining it with the standard treatment.
Got it. And thanks always so much for your answers, and I'll turn it over to Cynthia.
Hi.
Cindy, are you online?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. And, you know, have you quit flying all over the world? It seems like every time I see your Twitter handle, you're in a new place.
Where is Waldo, right?
Exactly. All right. Okay. Your questions?
I do have them. First of all, thank you, Dr. Kumar, for spending some time this evening. It's always enjoyable listening to you and your insights. But I guess I just want to go back and talk a little bit about, I guess a few years ago, the Black Swan Research Initiative started with these two curative possibly trials for smoldering myeloma, the ASCENT trial and the FUTURE trial. Can you just give us a summary of what those trials were, and are they open and enrolling, and
so
what's happening?
Yep, so the ASCENT trial is the one I can speak too much. I'm not very clear about the design for the other one. But the ASCENT trial is essentially, you know, we've been wanting to open this for a while, it's taken quite a bit of time because, again, it's gone back and forth with FDA. Originally, we wanted to try and do some transplant as part of it, but we got strong pushback from the FDA that maybe that's not the right thing to do right now, which is fine. So what we ended up deciding to do is take patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma and treat these patients with a combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and daratumumab. So we believe this combination of these four drugs represents one of the most effective agents that we have right now. So we will have high-risk smoldering patients receive this treatment for an initial 1 year with more intensity and the next 1 year at a lower intensity, more of a maintenance phase, but give treatment only for 2 years and then stop. And we will look at, you know, what is the risk of getting myeloma, what is the probability of getting a minimal residual disease negative status, and then also you just want to look at the natural history of what happens to these patients with smoldering myeloma. So our hope is that we can actually demonstrate that we can possibly cure some of these patients. If that does happen, then we would like to take it forward into a phase 3 trial.
Okay. Now, is this trial opened yet, or is it still
so opening? It is right now going through the initial, what we call the site initiation visit. So we have about 10 centers that it's going to open up. We have already had the initial, the pre-trial opening meetings with both at Indianapolis and also at Moffitt.
Okay. And is it a single-arm trial, or is it a randomized trial?
It's a single-arm trial.
Okay, so everyone will get the treatment for the couple-year period. Okay, great. So we'll have to keep updated on that one. My next question is about ASCO's coming up in a couple weeks. Are you expecting any exciting or practice-changing news about myeloma from ASCO?
I don't know if any of those would be practice-changing, but certainly I think there will be some interesting data coming out. I guess we'll have to wait and see the whole detail before really understanding what it means to practice.
Okay. My next question is, if I knew someone who was newly diagnosed with smoldering myeloma, what would you tell them as to what type of diagnostic testing they should be getting, what type of genetic testing they should be getting, what kind of ongoing surveillance they should be getting? Because many times when someone who's diagnosed with smoldering myeloma are diagnosed locally by a local doctor, it seems to be, oh, you don't need to worry about anything. And I'm thinking that's not the case. So what would you tell someone newly diagnosed with smoldering myeloma?
Good question. So I think the first thing is to make sure that we are dealing with smoldering myeloma and not myeloma that needs treatment. So I think it's important that in addition to the usual blood test, looking at the M spike and so forth, and the urine test, they also need what we call at least the advanced imaging studies. So either a PET CT or else an MRI of the spine to make sure there are no, other lesions that suggest that this may be more of a active myeloma and not a smoldering myeloma. And in terms of the genetic testing, obviously the bone marrow biopsy, right now I think we should at least get the FISH testing done on all these patients. The importance of the mutations, for example, on the risk of transformation of smoldering is still pretty unclear. So we'll have to wait and see the data before we do anything with it.
And then how often should they be, their blood should be tested? How often would more imaging should be done? What would the surveillance schedule be for someone with smoldering multiple myeloma?
Right. So I think the smoldering myeloma, the first time when you see the protein, you definitely want to repeat it at least 3 months later. If in 3 months it doesn't show any change, initially at least every 2 to 3 months you want to check it to get a sense of the trend. If it's pretty flat, then, you could probably ease out a little bit to maybe, every 3 to 4 or 3 to 5 months repeating the proteins.
And it should just be the blood test, or there any other testing that should be done, imaging later on, or bone marrow biopsies, anything like that? Or do you think blood tests are just good enough for the smoldering myeloma population?
Yeah, I think on a routine basis, like every 3 months, doing a blood test is sufficient. But at least once a year or once every 18 months, I think it's reasonable to think about doing a either a low-dose whole-body CT scan, which doesn't expose patients to a lot of radiation, but still is very sensitive to picking up abnormalities in the bone. So I think periodically doing that imaging study would be useful too.
Okay, that sounds great. Also, I was wondering, is there, I know you've been talking a little bit about this, but is there any progress being made through any of the trials or studies, the observational studies happening, that's allowing us to become better at predicting when MGUS or smoldering myeloma will move to active myeloma? And for people who are interested in contributing to that research, is there places where people can enroll in some type of registry who have smoldering myeloma that could help make that prediction in the future?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different registry type studies that are ongoing. We have some, looks like most of the most of the large institutions, academic institutions, have these sort of studies ongoing, and there's also a lot of interest in trying to have some of these registered, even started by the National Cancer Institute. So yeah, I think it's best just to try and find out which ones would be the closest to the individual.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's all my questions I have. I don't know if there's any callers on the line or there's some writing questions.
Yeah, there
thank
are
you so
a
much,
few.
Priya,
yeah, and thank you, Cindy. Priya, could you bring on the folks who are online or answer, talk about the questions that have been submitted?
Yeah, thank you, Gary. We have some callers who've lined up to ask Dr. Kumar some questions. Person calling on using 741-4487, please ask a question. Okay, we'll have another person. Person calling in using 3102127, please ask a question.
Yes, I was just, I'm a smolderer, and I'm interested in starting a trial. I'm not a high-risk smolderer, and I just wondered what Dr. Kumar's thoughts were on, there's maybe one or two trials out there now for smolderers who aren't high-risk, what he thinks about that.
So most of the kind of the interventional treatment-type trials for the for smoldering have been directed towards people with some kind of high-risk smoldering, whatever definition is used. As I said in the beginning, until we have some information saying that the truly high-risk smoldering myeloma is benefiting from treatment, I would be a bit hesitant on recommending treatment definitely, but in the clinical trials, it's perfectly fine. I'm guessing that most of the non-high-risk smoldering myeloma trials are looking at interventions which are very low risk of side effects. So I think it's certainly reasonable if you have a trial that you can access. I would strongly encourage participating in the trial.
Thank you, Doctor. Person calling in using 741-4487. Please ask your question. You're on air.
Okay. Can you hear me? Sometimes I have a bad connection to myself.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I read one time that a patient said the doctor proposed the induction therapy to be, say, Revlimid, something else, and dexamethasone. Well, I'll do two of those, but I don't want to take dexamethasone. And we can see how this goes, and then maybe down the road, if we need to add dex, I'll reconsider it. Because the patient didn't like the side effects from the dex. So is this, I realize the patient can be his own or her own advocate selections, but is that And I know it depends on a lot of factors, like the type of myeloma or the aggressiveness of it. But one, is that something reasonable? And secondly, it seems that steroids, including dexamethasone, can cause osteoporosis. And since myeloma destroys bones anyway, it puts holes in them, it seems like it's doubling the impact. Plus, the bisphosphonates are given to keep the bones together. So it seems like you're hitting the bones in two different ways. One, you're tearing them apart by using Dex, and patients may not even be informed of that. But on the other side of the coin, you're trying to preserve the bones with a bisphosphonate. Could you talk about all those factors and what your opinion of using Dex?
Yeah. So are you thinking about in the context of smoldering myeloma, or saying generally in myeloma treatment?
I'm sorry. No, this is beyond the smoldering stage.
Okay. Yeah.
Myeloma has been confirmed in the patient, and it's beyond that window of smoldering.
Yep.
Thank you, and I appreciate your answer and your help and time on this presentation.
Absolutely, yeah, you're welcome. So that's an important question that we have to start asking: how much do we really need the dexamethasone? Unfortunately, all the data that we have up until now has been in combination with dexamethasone, and we know that all the myeloma treatments work much better with the dexamethasone than without it. We did, in fact, do a clinical trial where we treated newly diagnosed patients with Revlimid alone without dexamethasone and then added dexamethasone only if there was no good response. I can tell you that the overall results with that approach was not as good as what we would have gotten with Revlimid and Dex started together. So that's one. But obviously the caveat there is we're just combining Revlimid and dexamethasone. What about if we did bortezomib lenalidomide and then remove the dexamethasone from that combination? We don't know the answer, but we certainly, right now, we are doing a trial where we are combining ixazomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone along with daratumumab, but the dexamethasone is only given for the first two cycles, and then we stop it. So we're trying to see if we have, like, really effective drugs like daratumumab, a proteasome inhibitor like ixazomib, and a immunomodulatory drug, lenalidomide. So three of the major classes of drugs in one package, then maybe we can do away with dexamethasone. So I think that those are the kind of trials which will hopefully going forward tell us what is the best way to deal with myeloma without the dexamethasone.
Okay, could I ask a follow-up?
Yep.
Thank you. So
your voice is breaking up there.
Sorry, is this any better?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I know the induction periods vary from patient to patient, but let's just say the average one is 6 months. Is that a period of time where Dex could cause osteoporosis?
No, I mean, you know, any amount of dexamethasone over time will cause some, slightly weakens the bone, but 6 months of the induction therapy with the dexamethasone, especially when you are getting the bisphosphonates and everything, I'm not too worried about the impact on the bone. I just want to make sure the patients get the best treatment possible.
Sure. And is it typical for a myeloma patient who gets that kind of induction therapy with dexamethasone, and because of the hard impact, is it typical to be for the oncology doctor to work perhaps with an endocrinologist or other bone density or mineral density, skeletal type of doctor specialist to monitor the bones? Because it seems like if not, you need a DEXA scan to see the density of the bones, and doesn't seem like that occurs very often with physicians who are, like oncologists who are working to cure the myeloma part, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's changed. Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I think myeloma, unlike many of the other cancers, particularly, you know, is really a multidisciplinary approach is what we need. Because you have kidney problems, you often need to have nephrologists, the bone problems, you know, require the help of endocrinologists and so forth. I think it varies. You know, in our own group, we have an endocrinologist who is part of our myeloma group. So, you know, we are quite fortunate to have that arrangement. But I think it's important to be proactive about the bone health. Clearly, using the bisphosphonates or the other similar drugs that strengthen the bones is clearly something that should be integral part of that myeloma management, irrespective of whether they have obvious bone disease or not.
Okay. Thank you very much. I know I've taken up a lot of time. I appreciate it. But if I have a chance to ask a second question or further questions, I will. Thank you very
sure,
much, Doctor.
Please. Yeah.
And thanks to Priya and everyone else.
Thank you. We have some questions on the website as well, Dr. Kumar. Is there a multiple myeloma genetic profile that is susceptible to cure by a particular triplet or quadruplet drug protocol?
So we don't have any genetic profiles that we know is going to be the most likely to benefit. We, you know, on the corollary, we do have some genetic profiles for the high-risk patients where we know the current treatments are not going to do very well. So I think that's what we need to focus on,
mm-hmm.
is to try and see if we can translate that information to treatment decisions.
The next question is, when will liquid biopsies be FDA approved for multiple myeloma? Also, will it be a valuable tool for genome sequencing too?
So I think the liquid biopsy, I think, you know, it's still a little ways away. I think we are just starting to scratch the surface of what all we can achieve with that. But I think it's very promising, and I'm quite hopeful that in the future we will be doing a lot less bone marrow biopsies than we have in the past.
Okay. The next question is from Manjunath, who writes in, what really does heterogeneity mean? Is this heterogeneity in the same antibody type? That is a different variable portion or epitope of the same exact antibody class? Or is this heterogeneity due to monomers and dimers or pentamers? Or does this refer to oligoclonal? Or does the heterogeneity refer to biclonal or triclonal? Can you explain clearly what the difference is with an example?
Well, you know, heterogeneity, I think, is definitely used in multiple different from a different perspectives. Typically, when we talk about the myeloma being a very heterogeneous disease, is because of the clinical behavior that two identical looking myelomas can behave very differently. So it's obviously a collection of kind of different diseases, so to speak, which are all bunched under the diagnosis of myeloma. But even within a patient, it can be quite heterogeneous because you can have multiple clones that all behave differently and respond differently to different drugs. So I think it's kind of a multidimensional definition when we talk about heterogeneity.
Mm-hmm. So that's the call to questions. If there's, if you have a question for Dr. Kumar, please press 1 on your keypad. We can bring you on air to ask your question. We do have some time more. If the panel has any questions, probably we can have another round. Gary, you're on.
Jack, do you have another question?
I'm okay. Mine have been answered. Thank you.
Okay. Cindy?
I'm fine for now. I'll start thinking, though.
Okay.
Okay.
So one of the, you know, there's a couple of drugs that are coming up, which I just read something, Dr. Kumar, that this Selinexor, seemed to be a drug that showed some positive results in penta-refractory patients, which, you know, it gives them another possibility. So what do you think about Selinexor?
No, I think the results that we have seen so far is quite encouraging. I mean, there's certainly patients who have stopped responding to all the other drugs still seems to at least, you know, maybe 20% of those patients respond to Selinexor. So I think there's promise there. There's also issues with some side effects that we need to learn how best to manage.
Okay. There's also another one which is kind of off the radar that I've noticed, but I know that the Seattle Cancer Care and Mayo and Dr. Alawadi, Mayo and Jacksonville is looking at, and it's called CLR-131. And
yep.
It happens to be apparently a drug that carries a little nuclear package in it, I guess. Could you explain that? And is that ready for prime time or no?
It's a way of, you know, using a radioactive substance close to the myeloma cell to try and see if we can get rid of it. I think it's very early on. It's too really, really too soon to say if it's going to have any benefit or not.
Well, I noticed that in the early studies that it said that, they had a 30% benefit rate and that the overall survival, progression-free survival was overall survival was 24 months and growing, so that, it was as good as what they saw with daratumumab. So that's why I asked that question, because early indications are that it's an amazing possibility.
Yeah, no, I guess we have to just stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Yeah, we have two
All
more
right.
followers.
All right, any other drug that you see coming down the pike?
I think the other one, obviously, that the BCMA antibody that was presented at ASH from GlaxoSmithKline is very interesting. There are similar other antibodies from other people, too. Then there are BiTE platforms, again, targeted towards BCMA. That's the bispecific T-cell engager drugs that, theoretically, that should have some good activity. There's a new IMiD or immunomodulatory drug like the successor to pomalidomide that is going through clinical trials. Seems to be of interest. So I think, there's quite a few. And, of course,
what about
the
melphalan? They got that new melphalan?
The melphalan?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's also, I think, early on. I mean, I'm sure it'll work. I mean, the question is we need to find out how differently does it or what advantages it would have over the other alkylating agents.
So there's a lot of great stuff, it seems like, coming down the pipeline as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing what you guys are doing. So keep that dream team dreaming.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have two more callers, Dr. Kumar, who want to ask a question. A person calling in using 209-9890, please ask your question.
Yes, thank you. This is Eric Hansen out of Juneau. You touched on this a little bit, Dr. Kumar, but is there any rationale, for example, at first relapse, is there any rationale really for going with one of the standard FDA-approved triplets, knowing, that I think all the research now is that that's a holding action. It will only last for, maybe a year, maybe two. Is there any rationale for using those triplets rather than going for a quadruplet and going for the home run, so to speak, on relapsed patients?
We don't know if a quadruplet is going to be a home run either, right? So I think that's what we need to study in the clinical trials. What we have learned in the past is, adding more drugs to a cocktail doesn't always translate to better results. For several reasons. One is, as you add more drugs, there's more side effects, and then you actually end up decreasing the dose of maybe the more effective drugs. Second is sometimes drugs could work against each other in a combination too. So all those things are unknown until you actually do a clinical trial. So I think even the four-drug quadruplet data that we have so far is so early on, it's really hard to know how much that fourth drug is adding to it. So I think we are all kind of struggling with the question. Let's say if you have a combination like VRD or KRD, and now you have daratumumab, do you just add that to it, or do you just add the daratumumab and take something else out of it? which would be a better approach, we don't know.
I see. Okay. And the second question is, at what testing do you do at first relapse, and then during treatment, how often do you repeat which tests? Are you always looking for mutations to arise, or can you just?
So we do, we certainly do a FISH test to make sure there's new 17p deletion or 1q amplification and things like that. But we also, in some of these patients, we do have the access to look at the mutation panels, and we use that especially in patients who have stopped responding to some of the common drugs.
Thank you, doctor. The next caller is 918-36086. Please ask your question.
Hi, this is Manju. Thank you very much, Dr. Shaji Kumar. I have a follow-up question on the answer that you provided earlier. So I have two questions. The first question is the heterogeneity that you said. I wanted to find out if, let's suppose somebody has IgG kappa. So are you saying that the multiple clones are all the clones within the IgG kappa itself? Or could it be like IgG kappa and IgG lambda? Because I thought that would be considered as biclonal. So this one, you're saying that heterogeneity is within IgG kappa itself.
Correct. So there will be within each of those, there will be heterogeneity.
Okay. So then the second question that I had was, in a certain patient, close relative of mine, before the start of chemo, the analysis, the free light chain assay showed a thin discrete band in IFE corresponding to the beta region. It was showing elevated lambda free chains.
Mm-hmm.
Post chemo, after 3.5 courses, what is being observed is IgG lambda. Before chemo, it was just the elevated free lambda chains. Now everything is normal, but IFE is actually showing IgG lambda in the gamma region. So would you consider this as oligoclonal band, or what do you think this is? Is this biclonal?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's hard to know for sure because this is also a lambda, so it's quite possible that he had a very faint IgG lambda to start with, and it was just kind of buried by the bigger spike of the light chain. So
okay.
The discrete band that was seen in the beta region is the lambda light chain. So it could be either of the two. And when you have this kind of the same isotype, sometimes it's much harder to be sure. So we'll just have to continue to watch that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it, Dr. Kumar.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar. Thank you very much for sharing all this information with us. We're almost at the end of our time. Gary, Jack, and Cindy, thanks for the great questions. And this talk will be available with its transcript for playback on curetalks.com. Thank you, everyone. Have a great evening.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar. Thanks, everybody.